Hi, welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and this week we are doing Cowboys and Aliens, and I'm joined by, well, my favourite alien. How are you, Ian?
Good, Mike. Thanks a lot.
And my favourite cowboy, Matt Wallen. How are you?
Fantastic.
So we have the benefit of actually doing a FX Guide VFX show, effectively live, as in we're all in the same room together, which is a bit unusual, really.
Very unusual, yeah. It's weird to see faces in front of me.
It was actually your idea.
Yeah, well, I thought it'd be fun to do a live show with a live audience.
Yeah, we've actually done that. It doesn't actually go as well as you think it will, because you tend to appeal to the audience, and if you're listening, you sort of feel like it's an in-joke and you're not quite in on.
Yeah, that's probably right.
And we do this for your benefit, listening as you are right now, driving, jogging, or rodoing as you are, wherever you are in the world, so we want you to not feel like we're doing it for somebody else. So we're going to look at Cowboys and Aliens, obviously. This is a pretty interesting film at a number of different levels. I guess it's bucking a couple of trends in that it's obviously shot on film, on Panavision, Panaflexes and stuff, and it's shot very much as a 2D film. Obviously, that's one of the reasons it's shot on film. But apart from anything else, it's a Western at its core, I feel. So, Matt, what did you think of the film?
Well, I mean, you know, it's definitely obviously a very high concept movie, like just from the title straight up, there's no denying that it's going to be a high concept fare. On paper, I think this is a movie that has huge promise. I mean, it seems like something that can't fail, right? You've got you've got the all-star cast, you got the director of Iron Man, the DP from Iron Man and Black Swan, you got the writers of Iron Man, Transformers, you've got Steven Spielberg, Ron Howard, Brian Grazer, Damon Lindelof from the Lost TV show. You got James Bond, Indiana Jones, ILM. Like, it seems like it should be a surefire.
Yeah, I can feel a butt coming on here.
Well, but my butt is, I actually think that it could have been quite camp and quite silly, because, I mean, it is actually, I think, a ridiculously silly title. I mean, I actually think it's a ridiculously silly comic. In fact, I think it's just downright stupid. But I don't think the film's stupid, but when I first heard of it, I thought, well, that's just stupid.
Yeah, I guess I would say, like, I think, you know, it certainly was entertaining. It reminded me a lot of, I don't know if you guys ever saw this movie, but back in, like, in the 80s, I think, early 80s, when I was a kid, I remember going to the movie theater and I saw a movie called Time Rider with Fred Ward and Peter Coyote.
I did not see that.
And it was Time Rider, The Adventures of Lyle Swan, where Fred Ward plays a, like, off-road motorbike race guy, and he has this cool motorcycle and this red leather outfit and this helmet that's sort of high tech with like a visor that comes down and a heads up display in the visor, and he's riding his bike through the desert in this race, and he stumbles across this military experiment in the desert, of course, right? And he gets sent back in time to the old sort of the Wild West, and he's like on his iron horse, right? And he gets back, and it's sort of this genre-bending, kind of genre-combining sort of film.
Right up until he ran out of petrol.
Pretty much, yeah. Right. But it's actually a pretty interesting film and has some cool moments in it. And it's sort of also like there was another Alex Cox movie, experimental kind of film called Walker with Ed Harris.
Okay, that's ringing a bell.
And there's a really kind of curious sort of time-bending thing that happens at the end. Now, this is not a time-bending movie, of course, but it's a genre, mixing film in terms of something we haven't seen before. But I kind of felt like, even though all these elements are there, I kind of felt like I didn't find that I really cared that much about any of the characters. Like, I wanted to feel like I was vested in who they were and what their struggles were and what was happening, but I don't know, it felt kind of flat to me. I didn't feel like the character arcs were, there were clumsy things about it that I felt like didn't work.
Anyone think of any name of any film in the history of cinema that had verses in it that you thought was a good name of a film?
Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Well, okay, my case rests.
Although,
Aliens versus Predators, my case rests.
But this is not Cowboys versus Aliens. It's actually Cowboys and Aliens.
Oh, that's right.
True.
Well, there are a couple of films with the word and in it. I'll give you that. Okay, now that being said, if you get away from the name, I actually think there are some really interesting points to this, because, of course, the idea of aliens coming, why would they need to come in, you know, current times? They've always come either when we're building pyramids or today, possibly the future. But, you know, to pick it into this period in time is actually quite an interesting concept. And, you know, how do people that don't really have understanding at an educational level about the sort of things that we would sort of be able to extrapolate, deal with flying and lasers and all the other stuff. So I think all of that's kind of interesting. I just think the name just struck me as being, well, yeah, it really struck me that it was just going to be camp. But obviously it wasn't, it isn't, and it has a great cast.
Yeah, and Mike, I agree. I think that's the whole point. It was a mashup of genres. It's Westerns and Aliens. But I actually think the premise wasn't so bad, and this is a spoiler, of course, but they're here to get gold. You know, and that's kind of a take on what happened
in
the Old
West. You
don't have
enough time between this is a spoiler and giving out the spoiler for someone to reach the off button. But okay, it's been out for a while, so we'll cut you some slack. But did you like it?
I came away from the movie saying that it was a really good, rollicking Saturday night film. I don't think I'd watch
I'd agree
it
with that.
Yeah, again. You know, sometimes you want to go and see a movie four times, mm-hmm. especially some big summer releases. But this one, you know, I would gladly go and see on a Saturday night, popcorn, and enjoy it that way. And I don't think it was a deep character study.
Well, yeah, and I guess that's like, how could you have expectations of a movie called Cowboys and Aliens that it would be much more? But I mean, I think you're right in that way it did work, although I felt like it could have gone even sort of bolder and braver into that territory. It could have been more brazen in terms of like this popcorn-y kind of vibe. Like it felt kind of almost tepid in that way. Like it didn't go far enough.
I thought it had really good homages to Westerns. Mm-hmm. Like I thought that it had a good Ford DNA. I think that was valid. And I think that the aliens were suitably alien-esque. And it wasn't like silly aliens, like where you just go, this is just the most ridiculous thing ever.
And for a long time, we were concerned about where Daniel Craig's character had come from. I thought they did that well. You know, weren't given all that information straight away. So it worked well as a bit of a mystery story.
Well, and that was one of the things that Todd put in the dossier, too, was like an interview with, and then I heard that Jeff Goldsmith, now he's new, he was creative screenwriting, now he does the Q&A podcast where he talks to screenwriters. And he was talking to two of the guys who helped sort of break the story and write the script. And they were talking about this same thing where, you know, you think of sort of the standard genre cliches of both a Western and then the standard kind of genre-esque cliches of an alien abduction film or something. And it's like, you know, you have the man with no name in a Western. So the film opens with Daniel Craig as sort of this man with no name. But why does he have no name? Well, he has no name because he's lost his memory because he's been abducted by aliens.
And right? He has a cut in his side like they've stolen a kidney.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was, you know. Okay, so let's move now to the visual effects, which were, as you said earlier, Matt, pretty much ILM.
The head-up displays from his bracelet.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which was good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they looked really good, actually.
Yeah, that
didn't
was
they?
Nice.
You know, that was good because it was believable tech. You know, like there was tech about it that was obviously for dramatic effect.
Right.
But there was like, you could sort of look at the display and you could kind of make out that it was
like
scanning the region,
yeah,
and that's all you needed to know. And it didn't look like it was an MTV or a, you know, Xbox controller.
Yeah,
and I thought that was really appropriate tech. It felt like it had intent. There wasn't just, you know, arbitrary stuff there for no apparent reason.
And the design of the bracelet and stuff I thought was cool too, like how it kind of fit on the wrist and the image in particular on the sort of, I guess it's really the teaser poster where you sort of see Daniel Craig from behind and he's got the hat and the vest, and it's the sort of classic Western sunset. You see that bracelet and stuff. It was cool. There was something about it that felt real gunslinger.
Well, but the other thing you got was the Jurassic Park water ripple effect, that it would start going beep, beep before you knew anything.
Yeah.
And it was just like that Jurassic Park where all the jaws kind of dun, 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 dun. And
yeah,
it was like, that's all you needed to know, that aliens were coming, which actually is a good way of doing it because, you know, you just get to that point where you think someone's going to die, and it's like, oh, you're in trouble now.
Yeah.
I thought that device worked terrifically well. I interrupted you. Was there anyone beyond MC?
Well, I think they were the two main companies, and there's a few others, Fuel and Shade, Ghost Effects and Garage Effects also added to the film. But it's definitely mostly an ILM production, obviously, for the ships and the aliens.
And it was Roger Guyette, I think, is the main ILM supervisor, I believe, on the show.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, so in this town of, what was it, Absolution, I think it was? Yeah?
That's right, Absolution.
Right.
the story takes place and it moves to suitable rocky place somewhere else. For the main kind of battle sequence. But in the middle, there's quite an interesting sequence in an upturned steamboat. And I've got to say, that shot of the upturned steamboat, I think, was one of the more arresting pictures that could have easily made it to a trailer. If I'd been picking trailer shots, I'd have put that one in. Upside down, in the middle of the desert, away from the water. It was well done, well executed, and I'm surprised that hasn't had more legs. And I guess you don't maybe think of it or something, but or maybe just didn't fit with their plans, but it was a cracker of a shot.
Yeah, well, I think there'd be another, you know, they talk about too, the two main sort of touchstone films from the two genres would be both The Searchers in terms of a Western and Close Encounters in terms of the alien component in a lot of ways. And that scene of the upturned paddle boat or whatever, you know, is just straight out of Close Encounters, the scene at the opening montage in Close Encounters where they come over the desert and there's that huge like tanker ship or something in the middle of the desert. Too. And so it feels like it's a direct homage to that, but it's something that's kind of more... yeah, right.
But as a visual effects shot, I thought it worked really well. You know, they see it sort of late in the day, don't they, at night or something like that.
And I think it's in just, the day, isn't
is it?
Like, I seem to remember.
I thought it might have even been raining and...
Could be.
Maybe I've missed... Yeah, but I thought, yeah, it's a great-looking shot.
It starts raining as they're approaching it, I think, right. And then they get into it to get out of the rain. Not that, that works very well because it leaks like a sieve having been just smashed upside down. I don't care that it was never really explained. I don't think it needs to be, and I think that the characters just need to be in a sense of awe. I just thought it was well done. So I guess I already just told you one of my favourite shots. So, Ian, what was kind of one of your favourite scenes from the film?
I really liked that opening attack on the town by the ships because they're kind of hidden for at least, you know, the first couple of parts of that sequence, so you don't really know what's attacking them. So, you know, there's so much going on in there. There's the planes actually flying in, the lights, the beams of light coming down, there's dust, they start blowing things up, then these grappling hooks start taking people away, and then you've got smoke and fire and dust and horses and, you know, eventually pulls out the bracelet and shoots.
You definitely have the Close Encounters light beams in the dark, you don't know what's going on, but there's something above you. And that ripping people out with the kind of lasso, I think they refer to it as a lasso, obviously it's more like a shooting hook thing.
The thing I liked
about... suitably menacing.
Yeah, definitely. I think the thing I liked about that sequence is that it didn't feel digital, it didn't feel like visual effects, it felt practical, and that was obviously because there's dust and smoke and horses and people in this plate, you know. Well, and yeah, also, you actually see the ship crash... You know, and that felt very real, too.
Yeah. And I thought those light beams, like, I mean, I almost thought those were, like, some practical element in the way that they had almost like, I was maybe, it reminded me of in, I guess it's in Alien and Aliens, they do the same thing where they use, like, a laser light, right? Like, something you see, like, at a club or something. And it had that same kind of aesthetic where it felt like there was... you know, particulate matter within the beam, and it looked like a practical thing. Like, it really was successful, I think, in that respect.
Yeah, I thought that stuff was good. It probably wasn't the most complex of the visual effects sequences because, you know, it was obviously helped a lot by you didn't see a lot versus, you know, some of the alien stuff where it's really out in the open and out. But... did you have a shot or a particular sequence you thought was really, really great, Matt?
I mean, there's two things in the movie that I made a note of that I thought were really great in particular. And one of them is sort of a subtle thing, but I really did like the look and what I thought was the successful sort of animation and presentation of the hummingbird, something that's really so simple. But it kind of reminded me a lot of something that... I remember seeing when they were working on Jumanji a long time ago at ILM, and it's something that... like, you know, you don't see unless you come to something like Seagraph, really. You know, you don't, or you maybe look at a DVD extra, but they had all these great walk and run cycles on turntables that were fully textured and enveloped and everything of, you know, zebras and elephants and stuff running. And they were so amazing. I remember just going into one of the view stations and looking at these things on the turntable, and it's like, God, you know, that's really, for all intents and purposes, it's indiscernible from a real animal. And I thought the hummingbird... you know, was something that I can't think of another movie where I've seen a hummingbird before. And it was a subtle effect, but it was so realistic and so kind of just kind of a neat thing that it was fun to look at. But the other thing, in terms of a really, I think just a big dramatic shot that was really good, although I think one of the shots in the sequence I had a kind of a beef with, but was the lifting off of the ship. And like the there's two shots in particular. The first shot where everything starts to come out, I thought was really
looking
great.
Looking up or looking down? Because there is a sort of a sky view looking down as it comes out of the earth.
The one looking down and then the one where it's in the sky.
Before it explodes?
Yes. And the explosion I thought was all right. But there was one shot in the sequence, which I think is the second shot, where they show it from the perspective of the ground looking off at it. And that was one where there were, I don't know, to me there were like either some comp issues or some scale issues in terms of the scale of the billowing of the dust. It looked too small to articulate what was supposed to be the size of the thing that we saw before it took off.
Yeah, and we're sort of with you. Like, it's almost like we expected to have a bigger, because a shuttle is obviously the main thing that one can relate to.
Right.
And because that's not in something but on something, you get a huge amount of sort of steam slash smoke coming out the sides. And also, I've got to say, the second that you saw that thing blow up in the air, I was just the shuttle. I
mean, yeah, it's unavoidable, right? Yeah, you can't have that and not see that, yeah.
Yeah, and you can't imagine that they did that without referencing the shuttle because as much as I personally still to this day, you know, feel bad about that incident, it's the definitive image that's burned into your brain about something big blowing up in, and those kind of shooting smoke tendrils that come out of it, you really need that, as opposed to prior to the shuttle launch, I think I would have expected to see like a kind of a rounder, more even kind of explosion.
Right.
And, you know, I think the second one of those, it's in the same category, is if a building comes down, it's 9/11. Like, there's just, you can't get away from it. It's like defined for our entire generation what that's going to be like and what happens as a consequence. But if you acknowledge that that's clearly what is sort of expected and what you sort of believe to be the case, then I got to say the particle work, the cloud sort of smoke sims, rather, the explosion stuff was faultless. It was great when it actually blew.
Yeah, I mean, I really felt like the bulk of the visual effects overall in the movie, and we can get into specific shots, but I mean, I thought overall it was pretty flawless. There was one or two things that I think weren't as great as the rest, but I mean, all the daylight lighting and you know, bright sunlight, the integration of the aliens into the environment, I thought was, you know, pretty flawless.
That's something actually I really liked, that you actually first saw that alien inside the overturned steamship or paddle boat, and then you also did see them in bright, bright, bright sunlight. Mm-hmm. So you got to see both, you know, types of effect. And I mean, maybe in the bright sunlight shots, the sequence, they're running around so much, so you didn't really get to see as much detail as I wanted to see in bright sunlight.
Yeah.
Whereas we got to see it up close in that nighttime boat shot, you know.
Let me discuss two things with you about the aliens, because I had the good fortune to go and sit down with the guys at ILM and discuss this one day a little while ago, a couple of weeks ago. And so I'm really tempered by that, because I therefore looked at it in the cinema, but I was really conscious of it. But I was incredibly impressed, and I think their work is impressive. You know the alien that gets slashed, in Daniel Craig's kind of, and it's a kind of a cut that if you have or haven't seen the film, you remember it's like on the sort of camera left side of the character, and it's a bit like a scar on a face, though we could argue where the character's face is fully stops and starts, but you get what I'm saying, like it's kind of a shoulder kind of thing. So what they did, which I thought was really interesting, is that in the skin around the outside of that now somewhat aged scar, because there's a significant amount of time that's passed between the initial cut and coming back to the shot when they're back in the operating theatre, and you get a really good full-on face look. And the alien virtually says, hey, see this scar on my face? That's what I'm about to do to you. The skin around the edge of the scar, just outside the immediate wound area, they'd added a kind of fungal, almost like the way that a scab forms, but almost like also reacted bacterially poorly, as if the alien had been exposed as a cut would be, but in an environment that was hostile to it. So it had had some kind of slightly negative infection.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'd actually textured up this really subtle paint job into the skin that gave it not only just an aging, but an aging and a where I'm in an alien environment and my wound isn't healing properly, but it wasn't a story point that it was like infected.
Mm-hmm.
It was just like such a kind of attention to detail. That and the way that they kept the aliens, who were considerably different in height, not looking like they were Jar Jar Binks and had their knees kind of too high and walked kind of gangly, because they were anatomically taller than humans and with higher knees than... And both of those things, I think, point to ILM's just proficiency at pulling off aliens, that there's that much thought into what would happen to a wound in a hostile environment that isn't your own hostile environment.
Sure.
And then B, that you can take a character that actually is kind of awkward to animate without looking comical because of that kind of long gangly thing and make it still look ferocious in full sun. Did either of those things you kind of notice when you're seeing the film?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I just love that particular scene you were just talking about then in the operating room, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't really just the visual effects. It was the moment between the two characters that I loved.
Right.
You know, they sort of lingered on it. They don't always do that in visual effect shots. You know, sometimes they're quite quick. And in that one in particular, you felt like they took their time.
They weren't going for a shock, gasp,
no.
pop kind of reaction.
Yeah, yeah, I guess I don't want to be a total contrarian, although I did kind of feel like, I think the lighting and the integration of them was you know, really solid. And I thought the gag that they used in that big battle scene outside, prior to him getting back into the ship or whatever, I thought the gag they used of showing a lot of the battle scene through the kid who was up on the hill with the spyglass, like having that sort of optical distortion and kind of the scratched, dirty lens and stuff was kind of a neat idea. And I think it helped, too, in terms of the overall sense of the integration of those things into the scene. But I did feel a little bit like, and again, this is probably just a personal preference kind of thing or personal taste kind of thing, but I did feel a little bit like the animation of the aliens in terms of their locomotion and how they would navigate over the landscape and how there's one shot in the interior where they're kind of almost like they're climbing really quickly, like upside down through like this tube.
At the operating theater before they engage, yeah.
Yeah, and there's something about those to me that, like, I guess the... And I think it's because of the design of the creature overall. The design sort of dictates the animation dynamics of the character. And I think they were so... They moved so quickly that they almost felt like...
It made them
feel CG, and they felt kind of weightless. Yeah, and they didn't seem as threatening as I think they could have felt. And in particular, there's one scene where... I guess it's where... It had a real video game kind of thing going on where Jake has a pump action rifle or something. I don't think it's a shotgun, or maybe it is a shotgun. And he's kind of cruising through the ship and he's like shooting alien after alien. And I was like, right away, I was just like, God, it's so weird. Like, I really feel like I'm actually watching someone play a video game at this one, in that one moment.
You know? But I quite like that scene because the audience got into that, you know, that he was gunslinging and just totally nailing them.
Yeah, it's a great, like, sort of vengeance kind of moment, I suppose.
I don't think that felt video gamey, though I can see it. I didn't feel it at the time. I felt a couple of the shots outside when they were jumping over, you know, things to kill people or taking out horses and stuff, they did feel a little light, I'll give you that. I should point out, I guess, that it isn't ILM's alien design per se. They built on the work that Legacy did. So that 10-foot creature they took further, but it was actually, I guess, that and the production designer, who is Scott Chamberlain. I'm sorry, Scott, to forget your name. But I thought ILM handled a 10-foot alien with badly, because I don't like any creature that gets tall like that and then has a lot of body mass.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I would personally say that, you know, I think of like tall and thin and lean,
right,
and gangly and thin, but I think if you've got body bulk, you tend to be shorter, squatter, and, well, more rhinoceros and, or at the other end of the spectrum, I don't know, giraffe or something, but I don't expect to cross a rhino with a giraffe and have a bulky, heavy thing on long legs with a long neck or long arms. So that didn't have much of a neck, that character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I would have felt like it would have needed to have been like, had a lower center of gravity, because it just doesn't feel like, now of course it's an alien, right? It can have any bloody center of gravity set of circumstances for being that
one. Kind of gravity they have.
Yeah. But you know, I mean, from what I'm used to experiencing, if you get really bulky, really plated with some kind of armor, the way a turtle is or a rhinoceros is or some kind of heavy beast that has that kind of, then you've got short legs, you squat, and you're not relying on speed and agility. You get to be fast and thin and long-legged, and then you're now a puma, and you're really lean, and you're a greyhound. So anyway, that was... So I'm giving them total points for making it as believable as they did, given they didn't get the character.
Yeah, and that's what, I guess that's kind of what I had in my notes too, was I was saying I don't think the animation was bad. I just think that the design and the direction of that design sort of dictated that they move in the way that they did, and I think they could have been potentially have a different kind of dynamic and been more threatening somehow in that way, because I'd never felt like anything was really truly in jeopardy, I guess, during that battle scene. And I would have, I personally think it, for me, it would have been more successful if I felt like there was some sense of danger.
Here's the thing about aliens, right? And I'm not having a go at Legacy, but don't you feel like everybody says our aliens should be insect-like because people don't like insects?
Mm.
But they don't actually come off as being insect-like. They nearly always want to be much more gorilla-esque or bipod-esque. So you're already fighting a downhill battle, because no insect is a kind of a two-legged stand-up, you know, open with their hands. And these guys seem to have four hands, right? Like a couple of extra set of hands.
Yeah, what did you guys think of that? Like, of the, like, I have to say, the Quato. Like, I kept thinking, like, get your ass to Mars, you know, like the Schwarzenegger thing.
Yeah. When the arms came out of the stomach.
Yeah. Another homage, maybe.
And was the mouth at the stomach, or was that...
I don't know.
It was a cool thing. It was a cool thing. What was that? It was some kind of like...
It was a cool thing, but it did feel like a bit of a just a design thing for the point.
Was there another mouth at the top of the head?
I don't know.
Is it necessary to have two heads?
I want to go back to the alien and insect thing that you were talking about, because I thought the aliens were most effective in the dark and when they were doing slow, subtle moves. That's when I was scared of them. That's when I thought people were in jeopardy. When they got outside and were getting either blown apart or doing really well, you didn't quite feel the scariness of them.
Okay, but I imagine a meeting at ILM, a mythical meeting, or maybe it's not ILM, maybe it's some other big trade company, right? Anyway, somebody walks in, a director, and he goes, I want these aliens. And everyone sits around with bated breath waiting for the thing. And I want the director person to say, I was thinking of something that's kind of furry and light-coloured and long-haired and really vicious, as opposed to, I want the alien that was in Star Trek, the movie that on the ice planet, which was, by the way, a bit related to the alien that was in this one, which is a bit related to the alien that was in Super 8, which was a bit related to the other alien that was in this other thing. I don't know, it's just this thing about it should be an alien and it should be insect-like, but they're not very insect-like, really. And as a consequence, they tend to have this... And they always got this kind of exoskeletal slime thing going.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, it's just... It's either that or they're the thing from E.T. Oh, sorry, Third Encounter, Close Encounter of the Third Kind, where they're the, you know, the long gangly with the big head and the big eyes, and they're super intelligent and are just here to be nice to us.
Do you think the other thing is that this is one of a number of films this summer, American summer, that have had, you know, an alien creature?
The alien that I liked most was the alien in the second original Star Wars Empire Strikes Back in the ice cave that Luke, you know...
The Wampa?
Is that the guy that he got hung up by his feet?
That
was a scary alien. That's my alien, right? Like, give me something that is just... That felt original, and they could only really do a guy in a suit back then. It wasn't a full CG character.
Yeah.
That was a good alien.
That was Howie Weed in the re-release of that, the modeler extraordinaire who did that.
Give me an alien that puts, you know, your lead female character in a gold bikini and ties a chain around her neck, and now you've got an alien that I can get behind.
Yeah, I think maybe she works down the street.
Okay.
But I was thinking, too, in terms of the alien, I think one of the things that they did that was kind of cool with this one was the integration of it into the environment, how it had well, it was sort of wet on the inside where it had its quarto or arms or whatever. Mm. But on the outside, it was really, it looked really dry, like it was a really dry, dusty kind of alien, and it fit well into that. And it kind of mimicked in a way the look of like sort of a dusty old cowboy who's been out.
Yeah,
the range,
it suited, you know, the old West environment, didn't it? When it was outdoors, it had a hard shell. And
in the talk that the screenwriters gave on one of those other shows, they were talking about how in the design of the alien, one of the things I think they were going for was this idea that they were sort of the scouts, you know, who were out there.
I think that was in the script, actually. We heard that.
Is it? Yeah, and they were out, like, gathering the...
Because they said
and
they're miners,
right? It's like, yeah, if they don't get... Exactly, that's right. It was in the script. They did say that. Like, if we don't get them, they're going to come back. That's the Olivia Wilde character, right?
What did you think of Olivia Wilde's... changing the subject slightly. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't know I could fix this body by pulling it out of the fire sequence. I mean, that's just gratuitous, like... appeal to the 16-year-old boys by having Olivia Wilde in the naked kind of post-burnt perfect state? Or was it... Because I actually think it was dramatic in the film. I didn't expect
her to
get out of the flames.
Yeah.
Once she was hanging around naked, I thought, okay, well, that's just... I know why they're doing that. But there was... It was a genuine good kind of plot twist for me. I hadn't picked her as an alien. Had you?
No, not at all. It was a good plot twist. The effect in the fire and the particles.
The fire, it was good,
yeah,
I thought.
I thought it looked really cool. It was a neat-looking effect. I will say, though, like, I did pick her as an alien.
Did you?
Yeah. She said, there's a line earlier on in the film where she says, either I'm not from around here or I'm from somewhere far away or something like that. And I was like, oh, okay.
Well, you knew that she knew him from a different way.
She was kind of shadowing him somehow.
Yeah,
for some
you knew
reason.
Something was up.
I thought it was a something up in a earthbound sense that she was his wife or something. That was going to be a twist. I didn't expect it to be, you know, the bug-eyed monster from Alpha Centauri that right. come down to kill the rest of the other aliens.
I quite like that she says they were just scouts and that, you know, you've got no idea what's coming.
It's a good plot device to give us a character that can explain to the cowboys and Indians, I guess, what's going on without, you know... I mean, because she served an enormous plot point, right, that she could kind of explain
exactly
to the audience and to them what was going on.
What did you guys think of the... You talked about the one instance of the beginning where the ships come into the town at night. Mm. But then there's that other big sequence that's almost like the roundup or something, right? Where all the ships come in bright daylight. And they have that huge sequence where those alien ships, which, you know, I do have some thoughts on the design of those ships as well and their form of locomotion. But those ships in bright daylight, like, I mean, what did...
And that sequence continuing on to them... being on the ship and...
Right.
Yeah, and falling in the water and then getting attacked right at the end. I really liked when they got pulled off the horses and things. I thought that was really dynamic and, you know, we were... Yeah, that was rollicking.
I thought him jumping off his horse onto the ship was so Indiana Jones. It has to be ironic.
Totally.
I thought the stuff was pretty good. I mean, they had a formation flying thing that I thought was good. It wasn't just sort of, you know, I remember in, what was that, 4th of July? I think it was, 4th of July. Independence Day. That I remember sort of thinking that everyone was just flying in every direction all the time.
Right.
I like these kind of had a formation coming out to attack and they looked like, why, did you have something about that you didn't like or?
Well, I guess I thought that, you know, the way that they looked overall in that sequence was good. I thought the shots where you saw, I think it's Olivia Wilde and Daniel Craig on the ship and they're before they fall in the water, I thought a couple of those, you know, it's sort of like the classic shot of like the green screen comp like in the car or something. It felt kind of like that and a couple of those felt...
You mean it felt like it was on a gimbal?
Yeah, and it's like against the green screen and they put the background...
There wasn't enough wind, was there? It should have been like...
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And like particulate and like...
If you open the window of your car at like just... you know, 35 miles an hour and put your head out, you really notice it.
Yeah.
It must have been going more than 35 miles an hour.
Totally. And there was something about that that I thought was weird. And I thought, again, it gets back again. I know this isn't the VFX design show, but I mean, in terms of the design of the ship and the animation of the ship, how it had all of those control surfaces that kind of came out of it and made it look almost like a... it was kind of cool in a way because it felt sort of Western and that it almost looked like some sort of Aztec... kind of shape or something. I don't know, like some weird thing that you'd see, some hieroglyphic. But then it had the same kind of... And it's interesting how these things kind of come, like it's like the Jungian collective unconscious or something, right? But the design of the ships and the locomotion of those ships, it felt really like sputtering, mechanical, exhaust kind of carbon dioxide.
Like, it was hit,
And it reminded me a lot of the ships in... did you guys see the Battle Los Angeles and all the like thrusters that kind of...
It did look a bit like
that. It kind of had that same kind of vibe going on. I thought it was sort of interesting to see that, you know, when you think of like the ship in Super 8 or something, you know, here we have these, the ships in this film, aside from the big ship, the smaller ships that are, I don't know if they were drones or if they were actually pilots in those, but, and then the ships in Battle Los Angeles, and they kind of had a similar kind of, they felt very much like machines, you know, in a way that I think we, you know, can traditionally understand a machine. So I don't know, I thought that was interesting.
What about the next bit of that sequence when they actually fall in the water and the alien jumps out? I was definitely scared. I just don't know if it was as successful as it could have been as it came out of the water.
I assume you mean didn't comp in properly?
I felt like part of that is because I think I knew it was going to jump out.
Did you know, or you knew intuitively knew? You knew because of the framing that was too easy?
Yeah. And maybe then it's not as a bigger surprise, even though it's a scary shot.
Yeah. I actually think it was a well-directed film, so I didn't have a problem with the, you know, kind of a couple of things that were well in film language. And if I was, which I wasn't, kind of not satisfied with the directing, there are enough really good actors on the screen. And if you get a really good actor like Sam Rockwell and you give him what it seems to be a relatively small role, he just is mesmerizing on the screen, and you just, you know, he carries it, gives it far more gravitas than it deserves, that role.
Yeah.
Stops it from being one-dimensional.
I definitely wanted more of him.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, obviously Harrison Ford wasn't just playing the hero. Yeah. And Daniel Craig, I mean, these guys can act. So I think that there was enough happening on the screen to kind of get, felt like the... Because what you're talking about, really, that kind of that knew it was coming, is some of that's just how the film gets set up. But it was a classic film in some respects, you know, like it's like the Western, right? You know what's going to happen with the Western.
Right.
Because we're so used to the genre, because we're so used to the framing.
And even that close-up shot of the ship when they're on it, and they probably are in a gimbal or something like that, maybe, you know, if we go back and look at scenes where maybe the characters are stuck on trains, you know, near the axles, I reckon maybe that was a reference to that shot, or you know, caught underneath a carriage.
Yeah. Maybe you make a good point,
it
for sure.
Like it was intentional, you know.
Now, I need you guys to help me here, because apparently it was terribly significant where the horizon line was in the Western stuff. A la Ford. Do we know movie lore to know well enough the significance of that kind of... Because it was like the framing was very... You know, you mentioned before, I think, the searches. Yeah.
Right. Well, I know that they were talking about how they were going to put this film together, and one of the things that I believe... Was it Spielberg or Ron Howard?
I think it was Spielberg.
Who insisted that they... get together, and he screened the searchers for him, and he talked through it and like kind of narrated what...
Was it that or Stagecoach or something like that, right?
Yeah, it was one of those. And talked specifically about some of the elements of the Western, and they had talked about how they were going to open the film and what was going to be the thing that was going to open the film. They talked about doing some sort of abduction-related scene in the opening or some alien-related thing. And I think it was Ron Howard who had said to them, he's like, look, you know, start in the Western, you know, open with the Western, start in the Western, and work your way in through to the alien stuff.
I loved that Daniel Craig didn't do sort of combined Western kung fu jiu-jitsu on those guys in the desert in the opening sequence. Like, that was, he was just like, hard man. He's an hard man, and he's going to not take any shit, and he's going to, you know, shoot that guy if he has to. But it wasn't like they updated it and made him, you know, able to kick and swing and punch and leap over horses. Like, it was just a good, solid I think there's a lot of film buff stuff in this, that in terms of like references to other films, references to stuff. But at the end of the day, I think most of it was just there for having like a good Saturday afternoon romp, you know?
Yeah, that's how I feel about it.
And the effects served that purpose.
They did.
But they didn't shortchange us. They didn't like not show the alien ship taking off or...
Do we have any kind of like indication of what the shot count was in this? Because I actually think it was actually probably not very high. Like I mean, unless there's like tons of sort of invisible effects that I wasn't really cognizant of. But it seems like there's a ton in the sort of battle sequence. But I mean, it gets back to that same thing too. Like I look at this and I still haven't seen the new Harry Potter film yet. But I did.
Shame on you.
Yeah, gotta go see that soon. But I. Like, I did go see Planet of the Apes the other night, and we were talking about Transformers 3 a couple weeks back and stuff. And I think that there are certainly some really groundbreaking things that are going on in those films. But I think, while this is a really fun movie, and they did some really great work in it, it's totally, for the most part, it's a really solid effects film with a solid body of work that looks pretty tight. I don't think there's anything in this, at least from my... take on it just watching it, that's like a real sort of groundbreaking film. It's just sort of like a good workhorse, like summer fun.
Yeah, and with well thought through, well executed stuff that stopped it from being a worse film, which let's face it, like you gave these effects and these script elements to somebody that wasn't as good at integrating stuff, and it would have just been silly. I mean, as I said at the outset, I thought it was a silly name. I understand it's from a comic book and all that kind of stuff. Sorry, graphic novel. But
Have you guys read that graphic novel or seen it, by the way?
Has anyone? I mean, really.
I've never heard of it.
Less people have read that than have read, like, you know, the time... Brief History of Time. Same thing.
Oh, yeah, right. Oh, yeah.
No one's ever read Brief History of Time. Everyone bought it, no one read it.
Right.
So,
that's true.
I don't know. I just feel like... yeah, I think you could have really fallen over with this film because they are playing it pretty straight and they're not doing it tongue-in-cheek. Mm-hmm. And at some point, if they just looked silly, then there would have been nowhere to go. I mean, it would have just been a mockery. Now, I put a lot of success of doing that, not just at ILM's feet, but at the director's feet.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, I think Favreau, like, is, I mean, surprisingly... really become just a pretty amazing director. Like, I don't know if you guys ever saw, like, out in Australia, that movie Swingers, like, sort of his first sort of acting, which I guess he didn't direct, but you know, he was involved in the sort of production aspects of that film as well. And, like, it's really neat to see a guy like him who's really, you know, I would imagine an actor's director, and he's really come into his own, like, as a full-blown filmmaker. I mean, he's a good filmmaker, like Elf, great movie, like...
he's a good filmmaker. And you know what? I think you kind of root for him. Like, yeah. I actually thought, I really hope this film goes well, because...
Because he seems like a cool dude.
Yeah. And, you know, if you imagine him, Ron Howard, Spielberg, I mean, that's a group of filmmakers who love film.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so, they would be geeking out on film the whole time, surely.
You know, it was interesting in the notes. Like, what did you guys see in the notes that early on they were going to cast... Robert Downey Jr. in the Daniel Craig role.
Which I guess would have been a...
Would have been so interesting because it would have been such a different, potentially such a different characterization of that central Jake character too, you know?
Because he plays it very straight, doesn't he, Daniel Craig? I mean, he's got the best line in the movie, don't you think, when they come off the ship into the water and he says to Olivia Wilde, really straight, we were in the air. We were flying.
No, a better line than that, he even delivers better than that, is when Harrison Ford says, I figure you owe me, and he punches him, and then he punches him back and says, I don't see it that way.
Yeah.
It's like, that's why you needed a tough guy. You needed an hard man to deliver that. And like, honestly, Daniel Craig, like, he came off as like a... And, you know, he's lean, he's like...
Yeah, yeah. He was good in that part, for sure.
Like he's...
And going back to Jon Favreau, I think, you know, you could feel the trust between him and ILM obviously developed on Iron Man. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, I don't know the shot count, but I actually would say there's probably a lot more work in there than we know. Digital matte paintings. Possibly
the interior of the ship. Maybe.
Yeah, and just gold. even the out exteriors.
Yeah, like gold stuff. Yeah. But still, it wouldn't have been, you know, astro numbers like we saw off many of the other blockbusters. But, you know, I mean, here's the thing. Like, he took Iron Man, which wasn't an A-grade property, I mean, really, Iron Man wasn't a character like a Batman, a Superman, or a...
Yeah, he's a lesser known.
Yeah, and just turn that character into one of the kind of rock star comic book characters.
Wait, he turned him into, like, Steve Jobs, you know, or something. Some, like, with muscles, you know.
Oh, no, but I mean, just, like, in terms of actual box office clout.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Iron Man is now a major, major property.
Yeah, totally.
And is... But that character is now, like, kind of a much more important character than, say, Thor.
Right.
Which I don't think anyone's walking around going, oh, my God, Thor kicked butt. I mean, you know my opinion on that film. But it just, it's not like Thor is now a central character and kind of...
No, it's true. You're totally right. Yeah.
And I think that... I think we want this film to go well at some level.
Mm.
And I think... But I don't think it needs to be everything to be successful. It doesn't need to top Harry Potter or Transformers, and it wasn't ever, I think, actually sort of meant to.
Yeah. It did feel like it, you know, it potentially was, I don't know what the budget overall was in terms of the production, but it seems like it might have been a smaller budget film in some ways. Although, I mean, it did have probably some big salaries in terms of the star power, I guess. But what did you guys think of, there's the other, one other sort of big effect shot that I thought was kind of an interesting one was the sort of flashback death of his wife on the table,
yeah.
Where she kind of does the slow cigarette burn, kind of like the guy from the X-Men movie. And I would
say,
and
there were different grades going on in those flashbacks. Did you see that as well?
Yeah. Really? It got really kind of like almost like what you'd see in a tilt shift, like an old style sort of tilt shift photo.
And it got that way also when Olivia Wilde's character was dying in his arms. Whenever she... It wasn't a flashback, but he was walking, carrying her, and she died.
Yeah, it was sort of saturated.
Yeah, was that a mistake, though? Because I saw that, too, and I thought, like, that was a weird... That was a weird thing. You think that was an intentional shot?
Oh, God, yeah. There's no way that would have got through as a mistake.
No.
No, God, no.
No, I think they were just going for the feeling that those two characters are connecting, and it's sort of reminding him of his wife.
And he's going into a bit of a kind of...
But it had that kind of, like, overly bright, kind of saturated kind of look to it.
Yeah, oversaturated look, yeah.
But I guess I thought that the death of the wife, like, turning to ash, the only thing about that I thought... I mean, I think the overall, like, the transition on the skin looked really cool, and, like... It looked like it was really solidly, if it was actually a transition to the live action actor, actress that was on the table, like the match move and stuff looked really clean and good. But I thought it was weird that her whole body is turning to ash and her flesh is burning and she's still moving, like her head and stuff. There was something about that seemed like it broke some sort of believability factor somehow.
I'm trying to remember, was that all in his memory, though? I mean, that she was turning to ash, or was that the real result of being...
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say, right?
Like, they never really... Could have been more of an ethereal, you know, kind of depiction of what happened.
Yeah.
Although I'm not sure about that. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a bad move on the part of that one alien to take off his bracelet.
Not a good move. Yeah. No. Wouldn't have had much of a film without it, though.
Key
in that respect. I was just actually trying to look up the budget for the film, and I can't see it. But I think I can't imagine that it was as big, nowhere near as big as obviously some of the other films that. Which sort of begs me to ask this question: if you had to say, in terms of effects films this summer,
mm-hmm.
I mean, just give me an above or below Transformers.
Below,
yeah.
Above or below Potter?
Below.
What about Rise? We haven't done this on the VFX show yet. Rise of the Planet of the Apes?
I would say below, but in a weird way, kind of, there's some equanimity there. Like, there's something kind of equal between those two. But below, in terms of, I think, just the caliber and the difficulty of that many hair-covered creatures, I think.
Well, clearly. On that score, then obviously the film we should be relating to is another mix of live action and digital characters. So above or below Smurfs?
I haven't seen it. I don't know.
Oh, really? I can't believe you didn't see Smurfs.
okay. I will say, though, I do have to say, my first ever student employee at Sony, Nathan Longest, a production services technician who monitors renders at night, a very important job and a very unsung hero, worked on the Smurfs film. And... he got his first screen credit.
Apparently, Smurfs is much better than anyone like
would
me
imagine.
Letting it get off the hook for being. And not only that, but I turned down multiple opportunities to do press stories on it because I just wasn't going to do Smurfs. And I may have to eat my...
That's you're just prejudiced against little tiny blue midgets.
I don't know about that. I think I might be prejudiced against really stupid films about...
The thing I like, Mike, though, about Cowboys and Aliens is that I don't actually feel like it was pushed as an effects film.
No, you know,
I think
not.
You're right.
And that's the best kind, and obviously ILM's work is amazing and all through it.
I think but in that regard, you could say it's closer maybe overall in terms of maybe budget, scope, overall feeling, effects, slash live action to something like Super 8. It's maybe more in that genre, like as a film.
Super 8 obviously referred to a genre in the sense of it referred to that kind of 70s Spielberg-y kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you could argue it was a bit cutesier. I think I have more love. I would, if you asked me that, I would put Super 8 above Cowboys because I just found that to be charming and endearing and really genuinely kind of wonderful. But look, here we are at SIGGRAPH in Vancouver, and I haven't seen any papers or technical presentations from ILM on Cowboys and Aliens. Are there? Have you seen any?
Haven't seen any, no.
I mean, it's not like it's been pushed as an effects film. It's not being marketed as such. It's not really... The aliens weren't pushed in the trailers.
Yeah, and they're not even showing sort of like their breakdown reel or anything from that film here. So
where obviously we've seen quite a lot of stuff from many of the other films.
But that works, doesn't it? You know, in some ways, you want that. You want ILM to use its existing infrastructure and whatever technologies it's been developing just to make good effects, fun effects. You know, it doesn't have to push the bar every film.
Yeah. No, I think that's true. Yeah, for sure.
Well, that's the thing about film that is here at SIGGRAPH, which is Cars 2, of which, you know, the biggest criticism you can make of Cars 2 is it isn't as remarkable as every other Pixar film as being remarkable. No one I've heard criticize Cars 2 as being a bad film or poorly made or unrealistic or bad animation. They've just said it isn't wholly remarkable, which is what we've come to expect from a studio that seems to have only made wholly remarkable films. And that's a hard one to answer because, yeah, I mean, you know, is it the worst thing in the world just to make a good film? And, you know, probably not. I mean, you know, it's probably exactly what you sort of, you know, hope somebody does do. So, I don't know. I think maybe the film misses out on maybe one sort of subplot that was more resonant or one mega effect sequence that more captured our imaginations. But, you know, again, not bad and definitely a lot of fun. And if you hadn't seen it and you've now had it spoiled by this podcast, it'd definitely be worth seeing it on... and I'm sure actually it'll go huge on video.
I mean, and just to add to that, Mike, as well, what I was really glad about was that it wasn't in stereo.
You really appreciated that?
Yeah, it was really great to see those landscapes and the aliens up close, but not have to, you know, wear the glasses.
You know, it's actually really hard to make a cowboy film in this modern day and age. I mean, if you think about it for a second, do you remember Silverado, which was the guy who did Grand Canyon, Candace?
Yeah, Lawrence Kasdan.
Thank you. And that should have been an absolute cracker of a Western because it had all the elements. And I don't think at the time it went particularly well. I loved it to death, but I don't remember. I think I was in a minority back then. And it's not hard. It's not an easy thing to pull off. And you know, there's like two genres that seem to be incredibly hard to make.
There were two really great westerns though in the last few years. There was 310 to Yuma, which I don't know
good
if you
film.
Saw that, but I thought that was a pretty solid movie, a remake, but a pretty good movie altogether. And Ed Harris made a movie with him and Viggo Mortensen and I think Renee Zellweger called Appaloosa, which is a pretty good Western
not
as well.
Not seen that.
Yeah. No,
but again, a smaller film that you know probably didn't do huge box office numbers, but a Western nonetheless.
Okay, well, so in summing up, good, solid work, good film, not necessarily going to be one that we just race out to get the limited edition 3 box set DVD version of, but not every film can be that, can it?
Mm-mm. I mean, a hell of a lot of fun, I think. Like, you know, definitely fun to go see. Like, if you've seen all the other big summer films and you're looking for something to do on a, you know, Friday or Saturday night, like, I think it's, you know, worth the price of admission. And, you know, if you're a fan of Cowboys or a fan of Alien films or, you know, a fan of any of these, you know, actors, or certainly maybe a fan of even like Jon Favreau or something, it's definitely worth checking out. Well, yeah, there you go. Who wouldn't be a fan of hers, yeah. Right?
Actually, I have finally got a budget number. Now, it's just an estimate. And obviously, it's could be completely wrong, but the budget is apparently $100 million. So that is actually quite considerable. If it had been 60, I'd have been way impressed.
Yeah,
you got to think the above the line cost on that could be quite a lot.
Yeah, I think probably with that kind of cast for sure.
Yeah. But look, I enjoyed it, and yeah, I would certainly not have felt like I didn't get my value for money at the box office. Okay. So look. We're here at SIGGRAPH. Have you seen anything really amazing just while we're here on in terms of VFX from films?
You know what? I will say I saw, and I think I saw you in there as well, Ian, was the there was a presentation that was sort of a co-presentation on the visual effects for both Thor and Captain America
and really good.
Marvel Studios. And probably the most impressive thing was it Luma? Who did the Skinny Steve?
Lola.
The Skinny Steve stuff, they did a big breakdown on that and talked a lot about how that was done. And I still haven't seen Captain America either, another one I've got to go check out.
Yeah.
But the stuff that they showed and the discussion they had about how it was done was really impressive. There was one shot in particular, I think they said, what was it? It was 240 hours on a flame to get it dialed in and to make it work right in terms of the they had the original actor, I think Chris Evans
is his name. Yep.
And then
and he actually is bulked up.
He's a
muscly
big guy. Yeah, he's like he looks like way. A you know condom stuffed with walnuts or something. You know, like he's like a huge guy.
And I thought I was the one. No, sorry.
Yeah, that's the description of Schwarzenegger, right? But he's big. He's a big guy. And they took his head and they scaled down his head, and they had another, like an actual actor who was real thin and sort of gangly, a British guy.
No, I'm sorry to pull you on this one. They did do that, but not most of the shots. We have a huge story on that on FX Guide, which Ian and I did, and actually, it was about 70% of the shots was actually, which is even more remarkable.
It was actually
Chris Evans. Chris shrunk.
Wow.
2D manipulation of Chris in the plate.
I mean, that is incredible. Because I haven't seen the movie, and it's one of those things where, you know, like if you've worked on any kind of films like this where you work on a shot, you know that, you know, when you go and see it in the theater, you still see the things that you think maybe aren't quite done yet, right? And you look at it and you're like, oh, it doesn't look right. But I'll be honest, like as a, you know, an aficionado of visual effects and as somebody who, you know, has worked on films, I saw those in that demo and I mean they were flawless. It blew my mind.
I think that sequence that Lola did is some of the best visual effects. It's certainly the best compositing we've seen in the last year, if
Absolutely.
Not the last decade.
Yeah,
that
incredible
is
standout.
Stuff.
That is just over the top.
That's probably the most mind-blowing thing I've seen so far at the conference.
I think Captain America is a mega film to be seen, and in fact isn't even a huge effects film in the sense of, you know, a Transformers.
Yeah.
But that work is literally some of the best compositing that's ever been done.
Absolutely.
Now, there's a pedigree, obviously, that got them there, and they built up from it. And there was a body double, as you said, but... They themselves were quick to point out, most people think they did a body double and just did the head replacement, and that was actually only one of three ways they did shots. Had a stand-in, they did a digital body sometimes, but mainly it was just cut the guy out of the plate, no 3D scans of the... Well, actually, they did do a 3D scan of the body of the actor that was used as the lighting reference. So if you see it on a DVD, you'll see a small, weedy guy standing in. But it wasn't that they used his body. They used him for height reference, for size reference, for what would happen with the lighting reference.
Right.
But they took the Chris Evans plate. They had a digital version of what they wanted Chris Evans to look like. They put that in the shot to just see what the light would do to it. Because obviously his biceps would cast shadows on his
forearm.
And they were irrelevant shadows because obviously they needed a non-muscly, non-walnutty, condom-y shadow. So they'd see how the shadows were falling on a weedy 3D guy and then throw that away. So they've thrown away both the weedy live-action plate and the weedy 3D plate, gone back to that plate, cut him out. They did have a clean plate, but oftentimes they couldn't use it because it wasn't motion control, and they just did the shot.
Yeah, that was what was impressive too, was they were saying that they had like what they called poor man's moco, okay, and what the guys at Lola called
rich man's moco.
Rich man's moco,
because
yeah, they were,
well, no, I think the VFX producer of the film called it rich man's moco because the shots cost more.
Yeah.
But then Lola put it back to poor man's loco because of the work that the artist had to do,
right,
hours and hours
was,
of
yeah,
tracking. Yeah.
Now Lola too, weren't they the company that did all the sort of de-aging effects
yeah,
in
yeah,
the X-Men something something film?
That was right. That was X-Men 3 at the beginning where they where
Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen are there.
Go, yeah,
yeah,
go back.
I mean, that was exciting stuff at that time, but I think this really, I mean,
it's amazing.
For
yeah,
me, it's so far has been the show stealer in a really kind of quiet, sort of subdued
well,
way.
Well, also
yeah,
did Social Network.
They did?
Oh,
the
right,
face
right,
for the twins.
And
right,
before that, they actually had about a decade of work, if not more, doing I'm an actor, I want my butt looking smaller, but it's in my contract, you'll never be able to say that you ever did it work. And it wasn't until they hit the X-Men stuff that they could actually do work and say they did it. Because
right,
clearly no one, like
yeah,
Patrick Stewart isn't putting in my contract,
yeah,
I want to look like I'm younger and die 21, I did it.
Yeah. Don't
and,
tell them about the time machine.
Yeah. And then they've just gone from win to win with that kind of work. They are the go-to place for that kind of work. And we debated actually having a whole VFX show on Captain America, but I think it would just mean me gushing at how friggin' awesome that
yeah,
sequence was
yeah,
and
yeah,
not much else.
I mean, it's a great opportunity to bring it up, just talking about stuff at Seagrav.
Yeah.
One other thing I do have to mention, I want to hear what you guys have seen so far, but one other thing I did want to mention, which I think I mentioned to you guys when we were going down the escalator before we came over here, but I love in the electronic theater, there's a short film, and forgive me to the makers of the short film, but I believe it's called
Paths of Hate.
Paths of Hate, and it's an animated short film with two World War II fighter planes, and the overall style of the film in terms of how it's rendered, it's kind of a vectory look, but it's a more sort of almost kind of a more sort of sensitive comic booky illustratorly
yeah, it's almost
look
like
to
you've
it,
got a storyboard that's come to life
yeah, and
but
it,
not badly.
It is fantastic.
Mm,
it is
yeah,
beautiful and incredibly well made.
You know these guys are here talking about it on one of the days.
Oh, they are, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I gotta
an interview lined up with them, I think.
Check that
we
out
did.
I mean it was amazing, and it really, I went to the electronic theater last night for the 2 full hours and watched everything. There's a lot of really great, fun, amazing stuff in the reel, but that one really, like, the audience, there was audible, like, you know, screams of delight at the end of it. People really responded to it.
Yeah, no, I think that's really, really good work. And obviously, different class of budget from the stuff we've been talking about. But yeah, no, really nice work. They're actually here talking about it at the show. What have you seen at the show that you really liked?
Oh, I like the Cowboys and the Captain America and Thor presentation as well. We saw Pixar, a director there, give a talk today on his short film La Luna, which was really cool.
Is it La Luna or La Luna?
La Luna,
I think it's La Luna.
Yeah, that was really good.
This is the third year in a row, Matt, we've done an interview with the director of a major Pixar short, and we were lucky enough that, like Ian came over and said, actually, we can get to the producer of La Luna. And I said, oh, great, but normally I do like a lot of research before we do an interview. And so he walked up, and I was really pleased to talk to him, obviously, because it's an addition to the director. But I was about to sort of think to myself, well, we're going to cover similar ground. And I discovered he was actually the producer of all three of the films
over
the last 3 years that we've done, which I guess is just a coincidence. But
yeah,
that's
what's
Day
his,
and Night.
What's his name?
It was Chris.
Kevin Hewer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, right on.
So Day and Night.
Partly Cloudy,
and of course La Luna. And if you think about it, it's three really different films.
Yeah.
Now, I'm pretty sure I'm saying Day and Night was Oscar nominated, right?
I'm not 100% sure.
I think it was, yeah.
It probably was.
I think
and,
it was, yeah.
Yeah, but I don't think it won. And no, it didn't win because the Australian short film won.
That's right.
And but this one was, if you get a chance to see it, I'd totally recommend it. It was shown at... it was launched in Europe,
at Annecy, yeah, the animation festival there.
And then it's here, and I asked the director when I was talking to him about it, and he said, well, this is actually only the second major sort of festival audience we've shown it to, so he was really enjoying watching it. Very personal story, completely different style, but what charming, I think, is a word that would come to mind.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I saw it last night. I was surprised
I saw it last night,
and I thought it was really great, but I was surprised to learn that it's not... Is there a short before Cars 2?
Yes, but it's the Hawaiian holiday of the Toy Story 3 characters.
Oh, interesting.
And in fact, we I don't know what we can say, but we know where this one's coming out. We kind of got a rundown on the schedule.
Oh, I see.
But yeah, this will appear in theatres.
Probably along with, what's that new Pixar film they showed a teaser poster of? Well, anyway, I'll just speculate in my mind.
Okay.
What about you, Mike? What's been good so far?
I'm trying to think of film VFX. I'm trying to stay away from... Because I've been doing a lot of stuff on...
I'll tell you something else I saw, which was amazing, which is the Electronic Theatre. And they just had live-action visual effects reels from each of the big houses, which was...
I'm really surprised that would appeal to you, Ian. Sitting by yourself in a cinema watching visual... That's like some kind of VFX orgy for you. It's like... it was like making of porn.
It was, and I had to leave early.
Oh, really?
Yeah, to go to another session. But
yeah, the Transformers 3 reel.
It's the best making of reel I've ever seen. The best.
Well, actually, okay, so I'll throw my hat in the ring, and we're going to do it in an upcoming show. There was a really great piece at the GeekFest Foundry Users Group on the making of Rise of Planet of the Apes, discussing deep compositing. And that was sensational. Cool. And I tell you why
it was
sensational.
Also brilliant.
Yeah, because the film is sensational. The visual effects are just stunning. But this was one aspect of it. And I think that's the thing I like about Sugarcraft the most, is that we obviously try and cover the whole film in the VFX show deliberately. In FX Guide and in the FX podcast, we try and drill down on just a shot. So, for example, Matt, we have a podcast at the moment with Peter Doyle discussing the grading of like two or three shots from Harry Potter. Yeah. And we picked ones that had no visual effects in them. Remarkable story of the amount of work that goes into grading what is otherwise a technically, you know, on paper, when you're doing the budget, you wouldn't think it would be a hard shot. And yet the level of love that went into them is astonishing. And so that's what you get at Sidgraph. You get this, like, I can get somebody talking about just one aspect of a film in immense depth, because quite often they'll have multiple papers on the film, and so you're just listening to the guy, as we did today, talk about Cars 2, lighting, one shot in one setup in Tokyo, and like what the problems were that he hit doing that. And that's the goal for me, just that. But the one on, we'll do a VFX show, I'm sure, on Return of Rise of Planet of the Apes of the Things. And somebody's got a t-shirt going, the VFX crew of the film, of the rising, of the Planet of the Apes.
I love it.
But yeah, it's definitely that kind of stuff that's... Because, you know, the other thing is, that won't make it on a DVD.
Yeah.
That material is often never released to any media outlets. You can show stuff at Sidgraph that you can't show anywhere else.
Well, and that's the thing I guess I would say to anybody and everybody listening to the show, people who, you know, tune in every once in a while to check out what it is that, you know, the films that we talk about or whatever, I think... If you get a chance ever to come to a Sidgraph, you know, I can't recommend it enough. I mean, it really is amazing, the kinds of things that you can come and see, the kind of people you get a chance to meet and talk with, and like a real kind of, you know, the opening keynote, where Cory Doctorow talked about...
Did you go to that?
I did, yeah, and Cory Doctorow talked about copyright and...
Was it good? You're the only person I know that went to it. None of
I think it was pretty interesting. I mean, I think...
For Sidgraph, was it relevant? That's the question that some people had.
Well, in a way. I mean, certainly it's relevant in a certain capacity at Sidgraph.
Right.
Because, I mean, Sidgraph isn't just the big effects films and the big effects houses. It's also, you know, scientific and medical visualization and hardware and, you know, academic papers and whatnot, too. So, I mean, it's a broad community. And that was the other thing I was going to say, was aside from the... I can tell you more about the Cory Doctorow thing if you want, but I just think it's a great sense of community that you get here. Like, I mean,
well, plus you just pass Ed Catmull in the corridor, you know, walk past that. Yep. It's like industry heavyweight after industry heavyweight, and you know what? You just learn so much about stuff, and these people are so generous with their time.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. It's a convivial environment where everybody's really just having a great time, and people are just so. You know, happy to have an opportunity to gather together and really talk about, you know, the kind of work that everybody is really enamored with.
If I can give a plug, we're going to publish this, so that's why I'm going to plug it. I hosted a panel here at Sidgraph with the basically the CTOs, I guess is probably the best way to describe it. They weren't actually all CTOs. I'm paraphrasing their actual job titles. But basically the chief technology officers from five of, you could easily argue, some of the best studios in the world. So that would be Weta, Blue Sky, ILM, DNEG, and Sony Imageworks. Is that the five? I think I've got all five. And yeah, so I basically, I hosted this, or rather moderated this panel hosted by NVIDIA discussing GPU applications in feature film production. And so that was, as you can imagine, a bit of a, you know, uber geek fest. But again, where are you going to get that kind of geek fest anywhere else? And these guys were discussing in real serious detail the kind of issues about getting fluid sims to work in a GPU environment, and sure, some of the issues about memory and caching, and how you get like vast cutting edge production done at, let's face it, vast computational sort of cost. And so we can post that on FX Guide. But again, one of those, you know, odd little corners of the industry from one respect, just GPU rendering. But well,
and I think too, you know, even if you're, you know, fancy yourself more of an artist when it comes to sort of visual effects or computer graphics, what have you, and you're maybe not as technical, coming to SIGGRAPH and taking some of your time, some of the time out of your schedule to attend some of the more technical presentations, even if a lot of it feels like it's going right over your head, the more time you spend sort of around that, listening to it, trying to understand what it is that they're describing, I think a lot of that starts to soak in, and you really do begin then to garner a greater and more significant knowledge base about you know, this industry as a whole.
Well, the other thing is really valuable. A lot of that tech ends up being used in films 2 or 3 years down the track.
Absolutely, you
know,
absolutely.
And it's quite good to know that before it, you then have to write an article on it or something, you know, or read about it.
Or work with it in some capacity, of course.
And then if it gets in a film, it's going to get into a package a year or so after that. Mm. So, you know, you hear a paper about, you know, whatever it is, deep compositing. Mm-hmm. And then the next time you hear about it or see it, it won't be a paper about it. It'll now be something that is maybe in a film and they used it, but they had to write their own code. After that, you're going to see that that's something that's supported in, you know, Nuke. And then the year after that, you're using it in a commercial. And, you know, year after that, it's considered old hat.
Yeah, light field cameras, computational photography.
I didn't find as much computational photography this year. Did you? Have you seen much?
There was a little bit in...
I'm hungry for that. I didn't see as much as I was hoping.
There's a couple papers on some issues related to computational photography. And at the keynote, there was actually some great... I mean, it's weird that I actually found this so enjoyable, because I was kept thinking, like, get to the keynote. That they had, like, awards that they gave out to some sort of luminaries in the industry, and they weren't really names that I recognized, but when you heard sort of their backgrounds and their careers of what some of these people who received various awards had done, it was really quite impressive, and some of the things they said about, like, the community of SIGGRAPH and about coming to the conference and what that's meant to them and the support that they've gotten by coming here from the community was nice, and it was really inspiring, and it really made you feel like, wow, this is a really neat thing to come and do.
We have a podcast with Ken Perlin, who anyone who's a 3D artist would know is Perlin Noise. And so he's actually on the New York chapter board, I believe. He's certainly a fellow of, you know, about 60 other things. He won an Academy Award, of course. But we got a podcast with him at the moment, and yeah, he talks about that community and how all of the Jim Blins and, you know, Jim Blin, for those that don't know, actually invented bump mapping. He's the guy that went, hey, I got an idea, let's perturb the normal, which, you know...
And the Blin material.
Worthy. Yeah. But of course, those guys all, you know, really took Ken Perlin under their, you know, wing and looked after him when early SIGGRAPHs when he was turning up and didn't know much. And so there's some Ken Perlin, there's some, you know, Ed Catmull walking around amongst us here at the show who's just befriended, you know, some guy who's writing the algorithms. I mean, we heard a great talk about, have you ever noticed that on metal, and it happens on cars if it's not a new car, that there seems to be like circular scratches? Mm-hmm. And so there was a whole lecture from Pixar about that phenomenon, and it was noted in like 1873.
183 years ago.
With silver polishing.
Yeah.
And that actually all the scratches aren't circular, but there's a phenomenon of the specular highlights that means that all the scratches that are at basically right angles to a central point radiating out from it will basically catch the light and cause it to look like a circular highlight. So not only were they discussing this phenomenon, but then how they implemented it on cars in Cars 2. And I mean, talk about drilling down on one point. This is like one aspect of one part of the paint. And we heard somebody who almost had to rush through the amount of detail involved in that for in like a 30-minute discussion. Mm. So, yeah, it's great. But yeah, I totally agree with you. It's the community. It's just all about the community. Anyway, enough of that. Thank you so much, Matt, for being with us. We really appreciate it. Oh, I know you're about as fried as we are.
Yeah.
Having had about 3 hours sleep as we have in the crew here. And thanks to all the crew here from FX Guide. Obviously, John Montgomery, who actually found the penthouse that we're in, the tech penthouse. We've got two floors here, which is great. And I've got a whole crew in from Chicago and from Sydney, including yourself, Ian. So thank you for being here.
Not a problem. Thank you.
And Matt, if people want to follow up and ask you questions or do anything, where's a good place for them to...
You can always find me at Virginia Commonwealth University School of the Arts, where I'm here representing my university here at Seagraph.
And wearing a sweatshirt.
And wearing my VCU Arts sweatshirt and trying to hook up some of my my students who recently graduated with interviews and whatnot at the job fair. Or on my website at mattwallen.com.
The job fair is actually really good here at Seagraph, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it's so much... There's basically every company you could imagine is out there looking to meet young people who've recently graduated, as well as maybe older artists who are looking to get back into working or transitioning into a new field. But there's game companies, film companies, some traditional like Leica is here doing another stop motion film. They've got a recruiting booth set up, and all the big names that you've heard of. Oh, one other thing, real quick, we know we're finishing up, but I do have to say, I don't know if you guys have checked any of this out, but there have been some great demos on Unity, the Unity product, the game design software, that is totally amazing and a hell of a lot of fun to check out for anybody out there who's interested in game development and game design. Really fun stuff.
But, good to know. And Ian, where can people find you?
VFX blog is my Twitter handle. And you can also see me on FX Guide.
Brilliant. And of course, I'm Mike Seymour, and I'm always over at FX Guide and FX PhD. Thanks so much for listening to us this time, and I hope you enjoyed the show. Please leave us some feedback there. On the actual FX Guide site, we obviously put up a link to the podcast when they get published, and there is a great place to leave comments. So you can just post comments there. We all read them. In fact, they get quite a lot of attention if you put a comment on the site. So we'd love to hear from you, good or bad, whatever you think. And please keep the suggestions coming. Once we get past the summer blockbusters, we're really hitting a bunch of the what we call retro shows. And I know people are looking forward to Poltergeist, and that is coming, but we've just got to get through some of these great films. And I believe we're going to do Rise of Planet of the Apes next, which I hope is the case, because I think it'll be a really interesting discussion. Way to go on the orangutan. Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour. Thanks so much for being with us. See you.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2012, FX Guide, LLC.